Bonjour à tous. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à cette rencontre avec Greg Brodmore, que nous avons la chance d'accueillir aux Utopiales, puisqu'il nous vient tout droit de Nouvelle-Zélande. D'ailleurs, je crois qu'il est encore un peu jet-lagué, donc, donc nous allons aller tranquillement. Et puis, Greg est ici pour nous présenter donc, son exposition, la très extraordinaire expérience du docteur Grorbort, qui est accompagnée aussi du livre que nous avons juste ici devant. Mais il est aussi designer pour une grande société de production d'effets spéciaux qui s'appelle Weta Workshop, aussi en Nouvelle-Zélande, et donc il travaille sur les grands films comme Le Seigneur des Anneaux, Avatar, District 9, King Kong, et j'en passe, il y en a beaucoup d'autres. Donc je crois que la meilleure chose que je puisse faire, c'est passer directement la parole à Greg Brodmore pour qu'il nous présente un petit peu sa personne et son travail. So hello Greg, thank you to be here. I'll just let you introduce you to the public, to the students of Nantes. So maybe could you tell us a few words about you and your work?
Yeah, is that going? Great. Yeah, so hello everyone. Thank you for coming along. So as Mary has said, I am from Wellington in New Zealand, and I work at a company called Weta Workshop, and we make special effects for movies, and there are a series of companies that are based there in Wellington, and we've worked on King Kong, Lord of the Rings, Avatar, District 9, and many, many others. And as you may know, at the moment we're working on The Hobbit. And so I work there in a part of the studio which focuses on design, on imagining these fantastical worlds. Yeah. And when I started, there were about 6 people. Now there are about 25. And we basically imagine and conceptualize these fantastic worlds from the ground up. Any feature film you've ever seen, of course, if it doesn't have if the object or the thing, the character is not real, it needs to be imagined by someone. And that's what a large team of us at Weta Workshop are doing. And the beautiful thing at Weta Workshop is that we are one of the last physical effects workshops doing these big films. So we not only design these objects, we build them. And so very shortly after designing a science fiction weapon or a robot or something like that, there is actually a physical object that I can go and see and touch, and that will eventually end up on screen. So
did you? Can you explain exactly what's your work on the objects?
What will happen is a client director, a feature filmmaker, will come to us, and they'll sometimes have a screenplay, and sometimes they won't have a screenplay, somewhere in between, and they will want us to imagine the world, and they will start firing ideas at us, like they need a character or a creature designed, and at that early stage, anything is possible. It could be the world is wide open. And so at the early stage, you might do dozens and dozens of different types of creatures, like the aliens from District 9, for instance. We probably did 500 different versions of them. And I'll actually show you some of the concept art from District 9, and I can talk about it as we go through and explain some of the processes and some of the different things that are needed when imagining a fantastical world like that. So if you want to throw up the image, there we go. So I don't know how many of you have seen District 9. Put your hand up. There you go, a few of you. Excellent. District 9 was a film that came out of the ashes of Halo. I don't know if you knew about the Halo, but Halo was a video game made by Bungie, and we were going to make a feature film of it, and we worked on it for probably 2 years. So 2 years of my life was working very hard on developing this feature film, and at the end of it, we didn't even get to produce anything. The whole thing fell over because of financial issues with the film. And so it was actually, as a film creator, it can be very, it can be quite depressing because, you put your heart and soul into a film only to have it end up never being seen. So none of the artwork I've done of that film will ever be seen by anyone. It will remain on our servers somewhere or printed on paper. So that can be, you get used to that as a filmmaker, that's part of the process. But the great thing about it was that District 9 came from it. Neil Blomkamp, who was directing the Halo feature film, had the opportunity with Peter Jackson to come up with his own idea instead, and that's where District 9 came. And for me, as an artist and as a designer, that was much more interesting and much more appealing because it was a blank slate. There was nothing designed for it. We got to imagine it from the ground up. Whereas Halo had been reimagining a video game and one that was based on well-known tropes from other bits of fiction, District 9 was made from whole cloth, so it's much more satisfying. So, and at the start of the process, this is an image that was probably about 3 or 4 months in, and we needed to very quickly make images that were key scenes from the film. So nothing you see here is the final object in the film. You know, like none of the weapons are the final weapons. The aliens are slightly different, but we're designing and imagining key scenes. And the idea here was to communicate these scenes to other people in the film project so they could see what we were making and get a good understanding for where we were going.
So you're working all the time with the team of the film? Mm. How does it go?
On this film, it's different for every film, but on District 9, I would work one-to-one with Neil Blomkamp. I would see him every day and talk to him every day. And it was a team of us at the start, probably about 6 or 7 people, working on different variations of designing the aliens and designing the spaceships and all this sort of thing. And then later on, it became very honed, where there was mainly 3 of us. There are a lot of people, there are probably hundreds, that worked on the film entirely at Weta. And then, of course, Weta's only one of the companies. There was other companies in Vancouver in Canada doing other facets of the film, like the computer graphics. But there was mainly 3 of us that were involved in designing the look of the film. And I focused on the technology. And another designer focused on the iconography, the graphics, and another artist focused on the alien designs. But we all did lots and bits and pieces. So, and this was great fun because these are getting to encapsulate very atmospheric moments. And here I was trying to convey in South Africa and in Africa they have a concept called muti, which just means medicine. And it's the alternative medicine, if you like, of that part of the world, and it's mostly based in superstition, and so. But it's very fascinating how it works, and quite scary a lot of it. So. But it's a concept that hadn't appeared in a film that I was aware of. So, and like all of this film was full of things that I hadn't seen in a major feature film before.
So how do you prepare yourself then to come into the subject? Do you have to prepare yourself a little bit to make researches or...?
Yeah. So, I mean, just at the start of a project, you just try to learn as much as possible. I would go on the internet, mainly, using the internet as a great resource, of course, and study as much as I could about South Africa. I watched many videos. I tracked down any information I could about the aspects. And, of course, Neil Blomkamp was sending me videos every day or sending me interesting things. And so I just tried to absorb as much as possible. With any project like this, if you're working on King Kong, then you want to study as much animal anatomy as possible, and you might want to study dinosaurs. Luckily, I was already a dinosaur nerd, so I love my dinosaurs, and I was very I knew a lot about that. But with every project, you try and study continuously, but you really cram at the start to learn as much.
And do you draw, or do you have a special medium to develop your ideas, or...?
Yes, so, I mean, for me, it starts very quickly with illustration. Mm-hmm. And I generally I do a very quick pencil drawing, and then I go straight into Photoshop. So all of these images are designed in Photoshop. And these are very quick as well, because when I do my personal artwork at home, I take as long as I need, and that might be a few hours or a few days, depending on the artwork. But for these, because it's for a feature film, there's a great commercial pressure. So I needed to do 2 or 3 of these images every day. And that's the same for everyone at Weta. We're working there, and you want to do as much work as you can, partially because the film only has so much time before you have to start shooting it, so you need to design everything so then you can start building it and then you can get it to set. And also partially because it's competitive. You're working with other designers and they all want to get their ideas in the film. Everyone, although it's a very friendly place and everyone is, there's great camaraderie there, there is still competition for the key aspects of the film. For instance, you can imagine on a film like The Hobbit that everyone wants to design the dragon. You know?
Do you have something to do with The Hobbit? Do you work on The Hobbit? Or?
No, I made a very difficult decision to focus on my own world and try and bring the Grodbort's world, which you'll see a little bit more of, as a feature film and as a video game. And so there, it's very difficult. There's only so much time in the day, and I want to focus my energies on my own world. So, yeah, as much as I'd love, I can't wait to see The Hobbit, but I have not really worked on it.
And you worked also on King Kong, but maybe you wanted to speak a little bit more about District 9?
Yeah, so I'll continue to go through these. I'll get the designs at the moment. That's a pretty gory one, so I'll flick past that. I'm a huge robot fan. I've always loved robots. I've been fascinated with them. And as a child, I loved RoboCop. It was one of my favorite movies. And so we knew in District 9 that we wanted this big action scene at the end with this giant robot. And so I think Neil Blomkamp, of course, is a huge fan of Verhoeven's movies and wanted to have this scene. So you can see very evidently here that you can see the influence of something like RoboCop. And we were very inspired by 1980s science fiction films, especially. And so all the weapons, of course, there were probably about 10 or 12 weapons designed for the film. And they were all great fun to make. And like I say, one of the really enjoyable things about working on a place like Weta is that I draw this picture. I might do 3 or 4 different illustrations. Neil chooses the one he likes the best. We make a couple little modifications. And then very shortly after that, we're building it. And then maybe 6 weeks later, it's there in the workshop, and you get to pick it up. And it's very, very satisfying, very rewarding experience to do that. And even better when you see it on screen.
Yeah, I guess.
And like I say, every single weapon had a different function. This was a gas thrower, and they all had specific things they needed to do. And they all have a little bit of sort of a scientific thinking behind them to a degree. At WESA, we focus very much on pragmatic design, making sure the design feels real, even if the basis of it might be very fantastical. And so here, for instance, there is a thought to the structure of how the weapon actually works. And this is basically like an explosive railgun where each of the little canisters accelerates a particle down the cannon. And there's a full fuel reservoir and a massive canister for the ammunition. And the weapons are designed to ergonomically work for the aliens in the movie. But the key thing about the aliens is that the aliens were actually a human proportion. And originally, they were going to be humans in a suit. And so even the guns needed to have a human aspect to them. They needed to have I've forgotten the word. They needed to be able to work for a person, because basically a person's going to hold them. An actor is going to have to run around with this on set.
Is that how you work also on Coldbot's story? Because you have a lot of guns. Maybe the people who are here could see the the guns.
You might notice that I am a little bit fascinated with weapons. And like I've said to many people, I'm not a violent person. I don't agree with violent solutions to any problem most of the time. But I am fascinated by weaponry and machinery and tanks and this kind of stuff. It's been the same way my whole life.
So you also try to keep the proportions in your guns in the exhibition?
Yeah. While the Grodbort's ray guns might look quite sophisticated and complicated and have a lot of detail, they're actually very easy to hold and comfortable, because I don't want them to be ridiculously over the top. I want them to be surprising in some aspect, but make a sort of sense. Like, you intuitively know that it's a gun, and you know which part to pick up and which way to point it. You know?
Except that they are very, very heavy.
They are heavy. Those ray guns are heavy.
Yeah.
Well, the pieces that you see upstairs are from a limited edition run, and they're all made in metal and glass, and consequently very expensive to manufacture. And so, like I say, when we're working on a film, we will do hundreds and hundreds of illustrations of various things. On a big film, you might end up doing thousands and thousands of illustrations altogether. And for instance, with this character, this is one of the soldiers from MNU. It was a multinational security force. And there's 3 illustrations, but of this particular design, I think we probably would have done a good 30 or 40 different variations between me and other artists before we finally settled on this one. And of course, South Africa was a really unique place to set a science fiction film, and very brave. I think it was lucky that District 9 even happened. It's all to do with, you know, the drive of someone like Neil Blomkamp and the foresight of someone like Peter Jackson, and that can basically take a risk on something like that, because Neil had never done a big feature film before, and so on paper, it's not the sort of film that's going to, you know, that's going to make it at a big Hollywood studio. You know, set in South Africa, there's no well-known leading person, there's no well-known actors in it. And so on paper, it's a very risky prospect. So it's very satisfying that it was able to make it out at all. Yeah. And so you can see here that I focused on the technology. It's kind of my thing, as you will see with Grootboots also. The technology of the film is what really appealed to me, designing spaceships. So it was very much a childhood dream. I mean, this is the sort of thing I would have drawn when I was, 12 years old. So to be doing it for a career is very surprising. And I tell you, I mean, New Zealand is 4 million people. When I grew up, it was about 3 million people. It's a very small country. And when I grew up, I did not think that I would ever be able to have a career. There's no comic industry there. If you want to make comics, you photocopy them and you can sell them for 50 cents. So I sort of assumed I would be unemployed. And I was actually unemployed on the unemployment benefit for 7 years of my life. And I kind of resigned myself to the fact that I'm always going to be unemployed. I'm always going to have no money. And so it's kind of a revelation when Lord of the Rings came out. And luckily I was living in Wellington. I had got pushed off the dole, and suddenly there was a place. I realized there's a place in my town. It's like, and they're making films. They're making fantastical films. It's like, oh, I have to work there. I need to go there. And so I sent my folio in. It had robots. It had ray guns. It had dinosaurs. And it just so happened that we were going to start working on Evangelion and King Kong. And Evangelion is another one of these films that we worked on for a long time and never made it out. And suddenly I had myself a job, and it's crazy to me, actually. I'm quite surprised.
What did you have as a background to get in Weta?
So I had very little in the way of background. I had no qualifications. I tried to get into a fine arts course, the best fine arts course. I thought I wanted to do fine art. I thought I wanted to be a traditional painter. And I tried to get into a fine arts course there, and they wouldn't have me. So I tried to get into a smaller fine arts course, and they wouldn't have me. And then someone quit the course, and so I went down there to Whanganui Polytech, and I started studying art, and for about 2 months I really enjoyed it, and then suddenly it just all changed. I decided, this sucks, I don't want to be here. And so I left, and I went on the dole again for several more years, and started playing punk rock. And I actually never lost interest in art and creating worlds and so on, but I just didn't do it for many years. So, Weta kind of almost saved me from a life of unemployment.
It's kind of a revenge also on life and on your... yeah.
And these are some of the robots. I'm going very slowly. I'll quick pick up the pace a little bit. The robots, as you can see, they're very different to the one that's actually in the film. There were lots and lots of design, and this is just a fragment of it. And you can see how radically different they are to the ones in the film. We even did this version as a large-scale robot that we actually built. We actually made it as probably a 9 to 10-foot tall suit that the actor could get inside. It opened up like this. You could actually get inside it. I don't know if you can see that very clearly. And we shipped it to South Africa, and they started shooting it, and then Neil Blomkamp decided that he changed his mind and he wanted something bigger and more aggressive, and that's where the new design came from. So in a very short amount of time, I had to sort of gather my thoughts and redesign a new thing, a new robot. And that's at the time, it's very disheartening, because I really loved the previous design. I was very happy with it. And then suddenly it's gone. And so you're racing it. But then, you know, the final result that ended up in the film was, of course, you know, even better. And as an artist, it's very satisfying to see something like this that you've made running around on the screen, blowing things up. It's a very childlike thrill.
How long did you work on this film, on District 9?
I think District 9 was probably maybe a year and a half to 2 years, something like that.
And how many pieces you think you had to make?
I think you can actually see on here there's a number. This number is 1036. And that was probably about three quarters of the way, maybe a bit further through the design. And I probably would have done a few hundred of those, I guess, at a guess. I didn't design the aliens, but I did work on their color scheme. The aliens were designed by an amazing American artist called David Meng. And this is actually a little CJ. He was one of the little baby alien, the young alien, and he was actually sculpted by Jamie Bess Warwick. We have some incredible sculptors at Weta Workshop, and it's a real privilege and a way for me. It's one of the best ways of learning as an artist is to be surrounded with these other fantastic artists that can teach me so much more.
Because all the districts are in Weta Workshop, all the section, all the artists.
Yeah, well, all the physical artists are at Weta Workshop, but then that's the people making costumes, designing, building props, making miniatures and things like this. But there's also Weta Digital, which is several other buildings, and that is hundreds of people doing the various facets of modeling and texturing and animating and compositing and all of that sort of stuff that involve with making the 3D. But of course, with this, like I said, with this film was actually the main part of the 3D was actually done in Canada. Okay. So you can see, even with the mothership, there were various different designs that ended up. This is one of the things that ended up on the cutting room floor, if you like. It didn't make it to the film. Originally, I'd hoped that we would build a. On the top of the spaceship, on top of the mothership, as you can see here, that there would actually be a village where the staff could work. So you'd catch a helicopter up and work up there. There's an airstrip. There would be a FedEx. There would be a Pizza Hut and a McDonald's, and you would live up there for 2 weeks and then do your shift and then come down. And also I wanted to have, in the feature film, I love the idea that the mothership had been there for 25 years. So the first week that you see the mothership, it's the most amazing thing in the world. A year later, it might be still amazing to look up and see this monstrosity in the sky. But 25 years later, it's basically just a big mountain. It's a hill. And so I imagine companies would fly up and they would put their advertising on the side. They would, you know, young people would fly up and or get up there somehow and put graffiti on it. So, but unfortunately, none of that made it into the film. It was a nice idea, though. And that's most of my work on District 9. Well, that's a little sneak peek at some of the stuff I've done for District 9. And now I'll show you and talk a little bit about the work I do in my personal time. And this is where the project of Dr. Grootboots came from.
Yeah, because they are linked now. So you when you work on Dr. Grootboots, you also work for Weta in a way. So could you explain us a little bit this link?
So when creatively satisfying as working on a feature film can be, I still have ideas when I go home. I've always got many, many thoughts that I want to get down onto paper. And so when I go home, I'll illustrate those. And one of the ideas I had was for this world of ray guns. And I started illustrating them, and then I showed them to Richard Taylor, who runs Weta Workshop. And he was enamored with the idea as well and loved it. And so we decided that we would make them as collectibles. And that sort of just kickstarted this whole thing rolling of like, well, okay, let's make this. I'll make a book that describes the world. I'll make another book. And then of course, the exhibition, and we started doing bits and pieces of animation. And it's just one of these things that grew out of Richard Taylor's respect and love for my work, and the opportunity that came from that. We have good friends that could manufacture these things, and so the opportunity was there, and so we started making them. But it all comes from, like I say, just like these idle moments. I would go home, and in a few hours, I would do an illustration of just something random, something that I'd thought of.
But when did you start to work on Dr. Grootboots?
So Grootboots probably started officially maybe 6 years ago or so. But I actually had the idea for ray guns and probably 15 or more years ago, maybe longer. I as I said, I love giant robots. I will draw them all day.
And we can see in your sketches sometimes, so we can see the beginning of the characters in your previous sketches.
Yes,
your
first you can. Sketches. This is a young boy that was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And could you, oh yeah, maybe we are not at the right image, but could you maybe describe us a little bit the story of Dr. Grobot, even if it's not really a story, it's more a universe?
World. Yeah, like I say, for me, and this is actually similar in one sense. When I imagine a science fiction or a fantasy world or something different, I imagine it from a point of view of a world, not a story. I don't think in terms of narrative. I always apply narrative afterwards. And so the way I come at something is from a universe, an alternative world, and stories can be told within that. So, for instance, this is an idea I had many years ago about the idea of samurai. What if the Japanese had been involved in World War One, in a meaningful way? So you supplanting all of the sides of World War One of Europe and supplanting it with the Japanese samurai. And I thought it would be an interesting set of images. It doesn't really have much of a story to it. It merely has, like, I knew the imagery would be interesting, and I wanted to see what that would look like. And if it connected with me, if I could see a wider perspective, I ended up doing probably half a dozen illustrations of this, and then I left it. Because, to me, there was no story there. It was really just interesting imagery. But that's the way it tends to start out. I will do something that attracts my eye or excites my imagination. And if it sparks more than that, then I will take it further, which
it's
is where
it's a long way process. So you keep the idea and develop it before maybe something is coming out of the on the paper. Yeah, well, on the screen, actually.
Robots, of course, feature in so much of my work. I love robots, and I see robots as caricatures, as basically a way of reflecting some aspect of humanity. You know? This is a lonely robot. He was wondering where all his friends are.
Yeah, actually, what is the place you give to the robots in the Grobot story? You have some robots. Mm. What are their role? What are they?
Well, in the Grobot's world, robots serve a slightly different function. The robots here are these giant individuals, you know. In Grobot's robots, they are, what's the best way to describe them? They're very much the cliched science fiction robot. The robot that you build for some utility, to be your servant, to be, you know, to serve you tea or, you know, to wash your dishes or whatever. But of course, robots in science fiction end up doing one thing, and that is turning on their masters and pulling their heads off. So.
And could you maybe describe us a little bit the characters, like Dr. Grobot? Who is Dr. Grobot?
I'll flick through this personal work into Dr. Grobot so we can see. I think you'll probably see many similar themes coming up. Oh, we'll flick past that one. And so, yes, Dr. Grobot. It is a world set in the 1920s or around the turn of the last century. Like I say, I've always been inspired by science fiction from that era. And I always wanted to make something that evoked that world. And so the Dr. Grobot's world is very much inspired for science fiction from H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, right through to Flash Gordon, and then the pulps of the 1940s and beyond. And so it's sort of aggregate of all the things I love about science fiction. These are some of a special one-off edition ray guns that we made. And you'll see a lot of this upstairs. So yeah, and did you want to ask some?
No, that's okay. Yeah, no, you can go on. I wanted you maybe to explain us also who is Lord Coxswain and what is this character? What does it mean in your universe? And maybe the link between Dr. Grobot and Lord Coxswain. Could you introduce us a little bit this topic?
Yeah, so Dr. Grobot is, of course, the name of the world. But Dr. Grobot is not really a character up the front. He is he's in the background. He is the inventor of the ray guns. He's basically the mad scientist, if you like, but probably more accurately, just a very acute businessman who makes rocket ships, ray guns, tanks, raspberry cordial, you know, children's shoes. You know, he would make any medicine, anything. He is basically the sort of Halliburton of this 1920s era that is a sort of monopoly on our planet. And his poster boy, the man who sort of represents as a hero to the people of this of the Grootboots world, is Lord Coxswain. And of course, the whole Grootboots world is very—it's very irreverent. It's not taking these subjects seriously. It's actually poking fun. Dr. Grootboot, as a main character, is a bad guy, not someone you should be aspiring to. And Lord Coxswain is the same. He is an anti-hero. He's an aristocratic buffoon, a moron, a misogynist, you know, a racist. He's a braggart and a loudmouth and an idiot. And so he's actually, he's not a good guy at all, but actually very, very fun to write stories from his perspective. And he's someone that that has absolutely no self-doubt. He believes in himself truthfully and fully. Because his ego is, as big as a mountain. And it's very fun to write stories about characters like this. And for me, a comparable character might be someone like the Monkey King from the famous Chinese legend, who is an irascible, loudmouth, arrogant young, person, an upstart who thinks he's in charge of the place. And then I suppose Homer Simpson from The Simpsons is another archetype in that, again, it's a character that represents all the good things and all the bad things about being a man, And then someone like Judge Dredd. As a child, I loved Judge Dredd, the 2000 AD comics. And as a child, I thought they were just great. I thought he was cool. But as an adult, I realized what a despicable sort of fascist he was. And so I aspire to the same types of characters that have a sort of duality to them.
And so we can see that also the environment of the Venus planet is really constructed. So you even thought about
the biology of
the biology and all the animals and bugs and
The big part, one of my favorite parts of working at a place like Werder is creature design, designing the creatures, designing dinosaurs or aliens or whatever. And so for Grootboots, I get to design my own aliens, my own creatures, and they get to invent interesting physiology for them. They need them to feel naturalistic. I want them to feel as if they sort of make sense, but also be quite surprising and quite different. And here you can see like a creature that has sort of ostensibly a structure that makes you think maybe he's kind of like an elephant of some type, is that sort of size. But he has six limbs, he has his ears in the wrong place, he has no obvious eyes. And it's very fun to sort of imagine this sort of biology. And the way I do it is, and like a lot of the people at Where to Do It, is to imagine, it's actually to research real animals and real physiology and learn, as much as I can about actual biology and about genetics, about natural selection, about how muscles attach, about, and apply that same logic to creature design. And what's interesting about design is that there's two things in opposition. One is pragmatism, trying to make it real and practical and believable. And the other thing is uniqueness, trying to make it stand out and be different. And these two concepts are in opposition with each other. And that's part of the fun and part of the challenge of doing good design.
Is it the same way you think about you did the portraits, like the portrait gallery that you told me they are people you
yes,
real
so
people,
the
I mean, and then so you change their face or you imagine their face in this universe?
A lot of the characters, a lot of the testimonials, the portraits of the various characters in the Dr. Grootboots world were actually people that wrote in from through the internet and submitted a testimonial. They submitted a story about how they had used one of the ray guns or something like this. And every week I would probably get hundreds and hundreds of these, and I would choose just one every week and illustrate them. And so at the end, I think I did it for a full year, so I had like 50 of these portraits, and they form a substantial chunk of the exhibition.
How far is going your exhibition? I mean, because this is a small part of your work, of Dr. Grootboot. Do you have how big is Dr. Grootboot in reality?
Well, there's a lot. You will see in the exhibition a great deal of it, but there is, of course, much behind the scenes that has never been seen. As I say, we're working on a feature film and developing the idea of a feature film, and so there is screeds of artwork there that has not been seen by anyone. There will be, hopefully, one day.
And so, Maybe what could you tell us? Maybe what's also you talking about the feature film, but do you have other project with Dr. Roberts? Is it could you continue it? Could you?
Yeah. So of course. As I say, I've released two books: The Dingus Directory, which we have some upstairs, and Victoire, the translation into French, which I'm very proud of, which just come out, and I've just finished a third book, which will probably be published for middle of next year. I don't have a name for it yet, though. And then on top of that, as I said, I'm a huge video game fan, and so we've been developing Dr. Grodbort's weapons and items for Team Fortress with Valve in Seattle. This is a picture of Venus in the Dr. Grodbort's world. And of course, the reality of Venus is that it's flat as a pancake. It's not a place with any life on it that we know of. But back in the early 1900s, Venus was a place of opportunity. We weren't sure what would be there. And so that concept very much appeals to me. You know, I look back at the science fiction of that era, and Venus had jungles, and we weren't sure what was under that atmosphere. And so it was a world of possibility. And Grodbort's treats that as if that was the actuality, that we went to Venus and there was actually jungles and animals there. And we went to Mars and there were canals and there were people. It's basically continuing that same mythology of science fiction that was established. Because now, of course, if you can tell a contemporary tale that goes to Venus or goes to Mars, well, none of this is going to be there. And then to me, that's kind of almost a shame, you know, like what science fiction creates is a mythology. And when you look back at it, there's some very fascinating and naive and quaint and interesting things that I love to embellish.
Actually, your work is linked to retrofuturism. Mm. So could you maybe explain us maybe more this envelope we put with your work?
I didn't know what Grodbort's was when I started it. I just knew that I loved science fiction from my childhood that I remembered. And it just so happened that most of that science fiction was from 1900 through to about the 1930s and some earlier. And I didn't know what that was called. I mean, I think the best way to describe it is retrofuturism. But other people have called it steampunk and dieselpunk and other things. To me, I really don't know what it is exactly. All I know is that it's inspired by the things that I loved. And it happens to be set in a specific time. And to me, it's not so different even from something like District 9. When we designed for District 9, we looked at 1980s science fiction, both movies and books and illustrations, and we took that as our influence. And so it's actually very similar in some ways. Although that movie's not set in the 80s, the inspiration for it definitely comes from that era.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many people will make any sense of this, but I'll quickly just go through these. It's a series of slides showing how an illustration sort of comes about, or some types of illustration can come about. So you can see it's very loose and gestural here. There's really not much to be made sense of. And with a little bit of texture and randomness, an image slowly starts to emerge. And this is one way of creating an illustration. It's not the only way. Of course, you can be meticulous and plan out a drawing in advance. But this particular way that I use probably about 20 or 30% of the time is a very organic, naturalistic way of illustrating and just seeing what emerges. This is the same sort of technique with just random brushstrokes to start with. It's very gestural. And you start to pick out detail and form from within it. And these illustrations are fairly quick, maybe like 4 or 5 hours or something like that. Actually, no, these ones are actually much quicker. This illustration is the opposite, where it had a very meticulous, detailed pencil drawing to start with. And this one probably took at least a full day, probably like a 10 or 12 hour day of illustrating. Yeah. And
yeah,
that's all the stuff I have.
Thank you for explaining us all these details. Maybe we have time to to have some questions.
Yeah, maybe some questions would be great.
I just wanted to ask you a last question.
Yeah.
It's the first time your exhibition is coming to France, actually.
Yeah.
And it's the first time you are coming to, you visit France and Nantes. And I wanted to know what was your first impression. Have you seen things in Nantes that were like...
I'm really super happy to be here. I mean, this is an amazing convention, amazing festival. I mean, I've done conventions like Comic-Con in the US, and they're very enjoyable, but nothing is very specific like this, where it's about science fiction, about reveling in science fiction. And in the birthplace of Jules Verne, where it has so much history, you know, it's actually almost feels like the perfect place, you know. It's a sort of right home for this type of exhibition. And, of course, I've had a little bit of a time to look around, and I had a brief tour of Les Machines yesterday, and there that is an astonishing place. That is like nothing I've ever seen. It made me feel a little bit at home because it felt a little bit like we're at a workshop and we do things that are sort of similar in some ways. But again, it's like that the giant elephant and all the giant creations, they are truly unique, truly world-class and unlike anything there is out there. So I know that a lot of people will be very jealous back at Weta from the fact that I've got to come here. I know Richard Taylor will be very jealous.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Alors peut-être que si vous avez des questions, vous pouvez lui adresser vos questions.
Yes. There's someone down here.
Je ne sais pas s'il y a quelqu'un avec un micro.
Is there a microphone down on the floor?
On va, je crois, amener un micro, voilà. Merci.
Oh, here we go.
Alors, il y a ici.
Okay, I would like to know what's your favorite work and maybe the work you think is the most, how do you say that? Le plus abouti.
De son travail, hein? Which one of your works you think it's the best created, the most, and went the achieved? Thank you.
Achieved.
Achieved.
Oh, achieved.
You know,
you mean of the film works I've done?
Of all your works.
Of your works. What's your favorite? And what you think is the most achieved, if it isn't the same.
Yeah. I think, honestly, it's probably District 9, working on District 9, because there's so many aspects to it that I loved. And working with someone like Neil, he had such an incredible vision and drive to take it to another level and, you know, really make it outstanding. So it's brilliant to work with someone like that who is a visionary, but also... you know, has the skill, basically, and the foresight to take it where it needs to go. And so it's a rare privilege to be able to work on a film of that scale, where everything comes together as well. For me, anyway, personally, the story comes together. I love the performance and the acting. So it's just it's really fun to be involved in a project like that. Yeah, that's my favorite in terms of film projects. I mean, I also love working on King Kong because I got to draw dinosaurs all day, you know, so...
You do the same work on King Kong that on District 9?
So the same.
The same work.
The same type of work. Yes. Yeah. I mean, on that, on District 9, I designed mainly the technology, but I worked on very many facets of the film. And on King Kong, I focused mainly on creatures and dinosaurs. Yeah.
Une autre question. Il y avait un monsieur qui avait une question juste tout à l'heure.
Hello. In first, sorry for to speak English like a Spanish cow. And why did people do a remake of a great classical like The Thing? I haven't seen the movie, but I heard about it. It's not so a great movie, and is a massacre of the original, the remake of John Carpenter.
Oh.
What do you think about this?
So is the question about a remake of The Thing? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know anything about the remake of that movie. I know I love the original. The original is an amazing film, but I know nothing about the remake. Is it already out? Has it already come out, or is it still coming?
I don't know.
Maybe you can ask your question specifically in French, and then you can translate it. It's out in America. Oh, is it any good? I have no idea either. Sorry. Give me your email address. I'll send you a review when it comes out. My personal opinion on remakes is that they're... apart from working on King Kong, is that they're generally a waste of time. I mean, I wish more original films were made. That's why I love working on District 9. Sometimes themes get repeated endlessly. People are interested in the same things. There are the same important things that there are to be human that get repeated in stories again and again and again. But I have no idea why. I mean, I know why. It's a business reason that people, you know, make sequels and make remakes. But to me, I just don't care. I really wish people would just make new stories. Yeah.
Bon, bah, moi, en ce qui me concerne, je suis content de vous connaître parce que je vous connaissais pas du tout, et je trouve ça très intéressant ce que vous dites. J'aimerais savoir si vous seriez attiré par tout ce qui est court-métrage d'animation ou film d'animation tout simplement, parce que je trouve que votre œuvre se prête assez à ça. Voilà.
So the question is about whether I'm interested in animation and whether Grodbots would be animated, I suppose. Yeah.
Also, yeah.
I mean, I love animation. I mean, it's my... I grew up loving animation, and animation is so integral to special effects anyway, you know, whether it be animating CG creatures or characters or whatever. There is actually on the Grodbots website, there is actually a little bit of footage we did of an animated version of the Grodbots world that we did as a kind of a test. And I would, I can definitely see a Grodbots animated film or short, but we'll just have to see what actually happens. The plan we have for a feature film at the moment, it's veering more towards a live action film, but we'll just have to see what happens. Yeah, for animation, I would love actually to do shorts. I would like to do quite more shorts for that are related to video game stuff. So.
Il y a une question juste là devant pour monsieur. Oui.
Okay. Good evening. Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You look much like a Vernian kite yourself. A Vernian.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, don't you have any plan or projects about making a film or illustration of children's work?
How do you mean, incorporating Jules Verne's work into...
Yeah, making illustrations.
Yeah. Sometimes I do illustrations that are inspired by other worlds. So, you know, every now and then I'll do an illustration for my website or something that's inspired by another work of fiction. But I tend not to do that. I tend to just come up with something new. And by that, I mean everything is... there's nothing new under the sun. Everything is a remix. So in my work, I think you'll see plenty of inspiration by Jules Verne. I mean, mm-hmm. His words inspired many artists who created versions of his works, and that's inspired me. So my work is a layer on top of that. But specifically, doing something based on Jules Verne, I haven't done anything. Not to say I won't, but I haven't so far.
Well, don't you think it would be a great exercise of style to do that?
Yeah, it totally would. I might get sued for copyright, though, if I put the Nautilus in the world of Dr. Grodbort.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Someone back here.
Vous parliez de steampunk. Est-ce que vous auriez envie de faire quelque chose de plus victorien, de plus belle époque que ce que vous faites actuellement?
No, the Grodbots world is actually sort of Edwardian, 1910 through to the 1930s, more or less in the sort of early 20s. I am fascinated by Victorian era, but there's so much other art out there that's doing that. Like for me, I'm always trying to find a place that's not being done. You know, if there's a lot of, I know my work is actually often considered steampunk, but as soon as someone labeled me steampunk, I kind of wanted to do something instantly different. that's what the effect of a label does on me psychologically. I'm like, that's not me. I wasn't doing that, you know. So I think there is plenty of beautiful work out there like that already, and that sort of serves. But also, I do every now and then. I collaborated with some American authors, Jeff and Anne Vandermeer, who have done steampunk books, and Lambshead T. Thackeray's Cabinet of Curiosities. And I collaborated with them to do some artwork that was more in that sort of era and style. So sometimes when the partnership is right, I will do that sort of thing. But for my own worlds, like if I do another world after Grodbort, I think it will be completely different. It won't necessarily be science fiction even. Yeah. Yes. Oh, there's another one at the front. Someone needs to be Johnny on the spot with the mic.
Hi.
Hey.
It's okay. Allez-y.
Yeah. I wanted to know when you have an idea. I suppose it pops up, can pop up at any time. How do you manage to put it on paper? Your work has so many details. How do you manage it? Do you put it on paper? List or quick sketches?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I tend to do, is if I have an idea, some sort of thought, I put it down as a sketch in a sketchbook very quickly. Or sometimes I might just write it down as a sentence. If it's more of a concept, it's something that requires a fair bit of thought, I might write a concept, you know. It can be... I wrote in my sketchbook a few months ago, sexy but disgusting cave woman. You know, like cave women that were both sexy but like revolting and unshaven, and their teeth are craggly and they got bones in their hair. I wanted to like make it so that I would be able to make these time, like rotten teeth, because they're, you know, in the prehistoric times. And it's just an interesting idea. I wrote it down as a sentence.
And then to the last sequence of King Kong when
attack, I can see in YouTube. And what's your feeling about the animation by computer versus handmade special effects? And I can read special makeups, great names like Rick Baker or others. Don't found so much work today, because the time is going on and
you should feel free to ask the question in French too, by the way. So, yeah, Mary can translate.
Oui. Je voulais savoir parce que de plus en plus le temps qui avance. Les films sont faits en images de synthèse, comme par exemple le dernier Tintin. Tout ça.
And it will continue to happen. But of course, there are pros and cons. There are dangers. That if you more and more of a world in a film is digital, then there is less tangible for an actor to connect with, and that's definitely one of the dangers. And so I believe a film needs to strike a balance of like making enough for the actors to connect and then choosing the best techniques possible to communicate visually what needs to be communicated. And it's very difficult. Every film has problems with finding that balance. And often, even though digital animation is by far, evidently, you know, the best way forward for creating, say, creatures or for other completely synthetic amalgams of the real world, you know, then... even though that's the case, there are still physical techniques that often become the best solution. So if you're making a robot, for instance, in a feature film, maybe if you need it to be doing backflips, it'll have to be CG. But maybe if you need it walking in the room or performing or doing something, maybe actually an animatronic puppet is the best thing. And the same thing goes for miniatures. Miniatures are a dying art in films. They are seldom used. They were used in Lord of the Rings, you know, successfully, but whether they get used in the future, it's not so sure. So it depends on the people making them. It depends on the director. It depends on on specific situations. But I think there's one thing for sure. Digital animation is not going to go away. So it's only going to get better, of course. And I love it, too. I mean, I love digital animation. If the right time goes into it with the right people, it produces the most incredible results. But like I say, it's a fine balance. You've got to find the right technique for the right job.
Donc on va prendre peut-être une dernière question avant de partir puisque c'est le temps de laisser la place au suivant, s'il y en a. Une dernière petite question.
Last question. Great.
Oh. Sur lesquels vous avez travaillé, est-ce que vous avez réussi, par exemple, à rencontrer Peter Jackson? Est-ce que vous avez travaillé avec lui? Et si oui, est-ce que vous avez trouvé ça intéressant ou,
Yeah, of course. He co-founded the Weta companies that I work with, and we see him every now and then down at the workshop. Of course, a lot of the people that work at Weta Workshop see him on set as he's making these films. He's an amazing person, amazing character. Because, like I say, when I grew up, there was no film industry in New Zealand. We were 4 million people. The biggest thing New Zealand made was sheep. You know, there's lots of sheep. There was no film industry. And there was no comic industry. There's no animation industry. There's no video games. And then single-handedly almost, or with the rallying support of other people or behind him, Peter Jackson managed to forge an industry that was world-class and making films for the entire world. And so I'm fairly indebted to him and his vision, you know, to make New Zealand a place where we can make some of these grand films. I'm very, very lucky, you know. I could have easily, if he hadn't done that, if he decided to go to Los Angeles, to Hollywood to do that, then my life probably would have been quite different. So.
Merci.
Alors, merci à vous pour toute votre attention. Thank you, Greg, for your words.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thanks for sticking through.
Et vous pouvez donc retrouver Greg dans son exposition tout à l'heure, juste sur la mezzanine, et probablement pour des signatures aussi pendant le week-end et d'autres rencontres. Voilà, merci.
Trente-cinq minutes.